Screen Time with John Fardy. This is News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Screen Time. I'm John Fardy and this is News Talk's TV and movie show. This week on the show, we take a deep dive into the Oscars when I chat with awards editor at Variety, Tim Gray, about this year's likely winners. Staying with the Oscars, we talk to man of the moment, Tom Moore, the co-director of Wolfwalkers and co-director of Cartoon Saloon, about his favorite movie and, of course, a possible Oscar win. Plus, Mark Ryle is here with all the week's new releases. I'm open on Twitter, John_Fardy. Or you can email me, screentime@newstalk.com. This show is available as a podcast every Friday at 5 p.m. on newstalk.com or the Newstalk app, or wherever you get your podcasts. And it's on the radio every Saturday at 6 p.m. right here on Newstalk. Now, I was off last week, and I guess I never told people that I was going to be off, and I was heartened to see that so many of you were in touch wondering where I was and hoping the show hadn't been cancelled, which it hasn't, not to the best of my knowledge. Tap, tap, hello. No, we're all still good. I was just having a little break for Easter, you know, as is my wont once in a while. Got to skip. I can't recommend to you how nice it is to empty your house of stuff that you've been looking at for years that you don't need and to fling it into a skip. I know a lot of people have been doing that in lockdown and we did it. It was amazing. It was kind of sad when the skip left, you know. So anyway. That's what I was doing for the week and enjoying it surprisingly a lot. Anyway, now in TV, I was very much enjoying this. Now that's Reeling in the Years by Steely Dan, but really it's just a theme tune to most people now for Reeling in the Years, the RTE show, which returned for the teens, I think they're called, or the tens, I should say, for 2010 to 2019. The first episode returned, or the first episode started with 2010. And, you know, sometimes people on this show say, you know, you're always talking about Netflix and Amazon and blah, blah, blah. You know, you talk about Irish shows. So I'm delighted to talk about Reeling in the Years because it was delightful and kind of strangely emotional to watch 2010. I got married that year. We and my wife, the Royal We, well, not the Royal we were the last plane out of Ireland the day or one of the days that they closed the airspace because of the ash cloud. That was in there. I mean, they didn't feature my wedding. More's the pity. But the ash cloud was there, the IMF coming, that horrible time with the Troika, the terrible weather. And you know what? Hats off to John O'Regan, who produces Reeling in the Years, because on the surface, it can seem like this is just a whole series of news clips put together. But there is such an art in choosing the right ones and putting them together. And there's such an art in playing telling clips that we now have a different sense of 10, 11 years later. That's the art. Like famously, I think it's from 1987 or 1986 when they were looking at the 80s and you have a clip of Charlie Haughey talking about what he would do if he won the lotto. And they end on him saying, well, I'd probably keep a bit for myself. There is genius at work in the editing of Reeling in the Years. There really is. And it appears I'm not the only one who thought it was great to see it back looking at the 2010s because over 500,000 people watched it. So there you go. Reeling in the Years, Sunday night in RTE. Fine TV, if you ask me. Now, a movie that was out last Friday that I didn't get to talk to you about on Amazon was Palm Springs, or is Palm Springs. Now, this is fascinating to me because this is a good movie. This is about a guy called Niles, who's played by the great actor Andy Samberg, who's at a wedding. And the thing is, he's at the same wedding every day. He's caught in this bizarre time loop. He wandered into a cave and now he's in some kind of time loop. And it keeps repeating over and over again. So when we meet him, he's really doesn't care much about life and he's drinking all day and he's just attending this wedding in Bermuda shorts and a Bermuda shirt. Enter another participant in this loop day, Sarah, played by Kristen Milioti, who enters the same time loop as him and she gets stuck in it and they're living it over and over and over again. It's very funny. There's a kind of dark humor to it, a sincerity as well about how we live our lives. But as you've heard from that description, the conceit of it is a carbon copy of Groundhog Day. I mean, it's executed differently, but it is the exact same template, except there is now another person in the Groundhog Day with him. Now, I really enjoyed the movie, but I just had this whole nagging doubt through it that this is, dare I say it, a ripoff of Groundhog Day. Now, I know that directors and producers and actors will say, no, it's completely different. And it is a completely different movie, but it is exactly the same idea, except two people are now in the Groundhog Day. I don't know what I thought of it because I really enjoyed it, but I was filled with this nagging, oh, this is Groundhog Day. So I'd love to know if you might have watched Palm Springs on Amazon. Let me know. I'm open on Twitter, John_Fardy, or you can email me screentime@newstalk.com. Now you're listening to Screen Time, News Talk's TV and movie show. Now, Oscar is finally very close. Sunday week, the Oscars will finally be happening, and they're happening more or less in person. They've banned Zoom calls, so people are going to be live and in person to a certain extent. I'm delighted to say I'm joined by, well, simply one of my favourite guests on this show, the award editor of the Bible of Hollywood, that is Variety, Tim Gray. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you, and happy to talk to you.
So listen, it's happening finally. You told me before you came on air, you just wrote another piece about the Oscars. It must seem to you like this has been going on forever, this year's Oscars.
Yeah, it has been going on forever. Well, a long time ago, I mean, way back in 2020, they postponed the Oscars till April 25th, which is about 2 months later than usual. Mm. But all the campaigning started on time. So this has been the longest campaign season. I've been writing columns about Oscars for 6 months now.
Wow.
Which is a bit of an overkill. but you know, I think when they set the date, they assumed we would be back up to speed. And we're not fully up to speed in terms of public gatherings, but closer than ever. So they're having the Oscars in multiple venues as opposed to just one, so they can get more of the nominees into the place, so they get more of the nominees actually there.
Yeah, so I was just going to ask you about that. So in order to have as many nominees as possible, there will be bi-locations, a couple of locations the cameras will zip around to, but there will be Hollywood stars on stages, right?
Yeah, I mean what they've done in the past is they've allowed nominees to bring always one guest, but yeah, sometimes two guests, and you know, plus ABC, which has the telecast rights to it, they get a lot of seats. Now this year, they're telling the nominees, you get one guest, that's it, and
right.
So they're filming it at the Dolby Theater where they usually hold it. They're also filming it, which was an interesting choice, Union Station, which is a very beautiful building in downtown Los Angeles, a train station. And it has a vast courtyard. But also there's been talk about, can they set up an alternate plan in Europe? Because, you know, there's a lot of nominees from Europe and they don't want to fly. So you know, and the Academy decreed that there will be no remote segments, nobody accepting from their home.
Yeah.
But you know, which sounds good in theory, but it's like, yes, but if your home is in Dublin or London or Paris, then what are you supposed to do?
So there is not going to be a European center then. They're not going to anywhere in London or?
Well, they haven't announced it yet. I did a column a few months ago talking about the year after Pearl Harbor was bombed, because Pearl Harbor was bombed in December 1941, and the Oscars were scheduled a few months later. And they went back and forth with Variety archive show that they would announce, okay, we're not holding an Oscar ceremony this year. Well, actually, we are holding a ceremony, but it's going to be subdued. No ceremony. Yes, there is a ceremony. They changed their mind a lot. And so I said, you can expect last minute decisions here. So far, they haven't announced a European headquarters for the Oscars. But I think it's possible.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we will see. We still have a little over a week. So listen, let's get to the meat and potatoes, and my listeners can, you know, get their betting slips at the ready, because Tim knows a lot about these things. You might even make some money on this, listeners, because, you know, Tim's rarely wrong. But so, actor in a leading role, the wins and the BAFTAs are saying Chadwick Boseman. What do you think?
I think it is Chadwick Boseman. You know, I will say a little disclaimer here. I never bet money on Oscar pools. I never bet like £5 because I think, you know, it's too unpredictable. But yeah. I think Chadwick Boseman is a pretty sure bet. He's really good in the film Ma Rainey's Black Bottom. And, you know, the kind of poignancy that it's his final role.
Yeah,
he knew he was dying when he did it. He knew this was going to be his farewell. I mean, you know, it's pretty hard to resist a backstory like that.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And despite, you know, all the, you know, poignancy of him winning, he does deserve it based on the performance. I'm just wondering, though, later in the show, we're talking about Sound of Metal. I was blown away by that. Do you think Riz Ahmed might possibly have an outside chance?
I do think he does. I mean, I think, you know, it's very hard this year to predict because there's a lot of good possibilities. I think Chadwick Boseman, I think, is the front runner, but Anthony Hopkins in The Father is spectacular. And Riz Ahmed is like, I mean, he just comes in like gangbusters. I really like that film, too. And I will say, if listeners haven't seen it yet, hang in there, because the first 10 minutes, you think it's going to be about a movie about heavy metal. And, you know, I think some people might give up, but it turns out to be really, really interesting.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And we're talking about that a little later in the show. Actor in a supporting role then, Tim, is there any chance Sacha Baron Cohen might get it for Trial of the Chicago 7 just to be a curveball?
I think he's a possibility. Also, he had a good year with the Borat movie. And so his performance in Trial of the Chicago 7 is a reminder that he's a genuine actor as opposed to being a comic figure. I kind of think it's going to be Daniel Kaluuya, who won the BAFTA for Judas and the Black Messiah. You know, it's a very electric performance. But, you know, again, all of these people are really good. I interviewed also Paul Racy, who's in Sound of Metal, who's so great in that movie. I mean, you know, and my gauge for performance is always, could you picture another actor playing this part? And with him, you think, I cannot imagine anybody else playing the part as well as he did.
Yeah, well said. And great, we can start trading who we've interviewed this year, because we go to actress in a leading role, and I'm over-egging it, but I did talk to Vanessa Kirby and Viola Davis this year and Kerry Mulligan. And to me, this is the hardest one to call, because as well as those, you have Andrea Day in The United States versus Billie Holiday. Even though that wasn't an amazing film, I thought her performance was brilliant. And Frances McDormand, I've actually seen in No Man Land as well, I thought was brilliant. And the three others I mentioned who I've spoken to are excellent. So I don't have a clue who's going to win this. What are your thoughts?
Well, I think nobody has a clue who's going to win. I do think... And this is one of the hardest races to predict, because if you look at those five performances, any one of them could be an Oscar winner. You know, there's none where you think, oh, that would be kind of embarrassing if she wins, or she was good, but she wasn't that good. You know, there's none of that this year. It's like all five of those are really spectacular performances. I'm guessing Viola Davis is going to win for...
Right, okay.
But you know, I wouldn't bet money on it, because it's not a sure deal. With Kerry Mulligan, a lot of people liked that movie, liked that performance. Frances McDormand, Nomadland has maintained its momentum. That was one of the first movies to really enter the Oscar race, and everybody was predicting it would take a lot of awards. And it's hard to maintain that momentum as a front runner for so long, but it has. And yeah. Frances McDormand, you know, the conventional wisdom says, well, she's already won two, so she doesn't need a third one. And it's like, nobody needs an Oscar. but she is... she's revered, I think, by people in the industry, and more than just respected. So I think if she had three, I think people would be okay with that.
Yeah, well, as Robin Williams said, it's nice, it holds the mail. But for my money, right, and this is a real left-of-field one, but I've said it on this show before, the most affecting performance in those five movies for me was Vanessa Kirby from Pieces of a Woman. She was amazing in that. So I'd actually love to see her win. I actually think she's the most deserving. I do think Carey Mulligan is going to win, though. I think the wind might be with her. But look, not that I want to disagree with the great Tim Gray, but we'll see. Tell me this.
Feel free to disagree.
Supporting actress then, again, kind of complicated because you've got Maria Bakalova from the Borat movie Glenn Close in Hillbilly Elegy, Olivia Colman in The Father, Amanda Seyfried in Mank, and Yoo Young-Yong from Minari, who is great as well. What are your thoughts on this?
I'm guessing Yoo Jung-yeon for Minari. It's a little film, and when it opened, people were saying, you know, boy, it's a little film. I don't know if it can get the Oscar attention, but it seemed to be building support. And it's about a Korean family who comes to America in the 80s trying to start a new life, and she's the grandmother. And she's just terrific in it. So I kind of think it's her year. But again, Oscar always has surprises. So it's possible it'll go to somebody else. But
yeah. And there might, I agree with you that, and that was one of our favorite movies of the year so far here in this show. It came out 2 weeks ago here in Ireland. Again, I'm name dropping. I'm in the company to do it though. Glenn Close, who was on this show earlier in the year for Hillbilly Elegy. There could be something around, you know, she's one of those people, she's never won an Oscar. She's probably deserving of one when you look at the length of her career. So would she be an outside chance, do you think?
Yeah, I do think because, you know, a lot of the publicity mentions that this is her eighth nomination and she's never won. And when you look at her career, for me in particular, Fatal Attraction in 87, where she plays the spurned lover, I would have given her the Oscar for that one because it's such a memorable performance. But she's been terrific many times, including a few years ago in The Wife, when people were predicting that she was going to win Best Actress. So there's a lot of support, a lot of affection and respect for Glenn Close. So I do think she has a chance. The other thing about Oscars is there's always a surprise. You know, the conventional wisdom says it's going to be these seven winners. And there's one or two where you just think, boy, that's out of left field. I didn't see that one coming. So, I think supporting actress could be that category.
Cool. Well, listen, en route to the overall best feature film, let me ask you just quickly two ones which we're interested in, one in particular on this side of the world. But firstly, best director, who do you think that might go to?
Well, I think I'm pretty sure it's Chloe Zhao. She directed Nomadland and she's won like everything. I mean, she's won Critics Awards. She won the BAFTA. She won the Directors Guild Award recently, which is always a good predictor. There's only been one woman director who won the Oscar in the past 92 years.
Yeah, and it's incredible.
And so I think a lot of voters were hoping there would be a good woman director. But I think if Chloe Zhao does win, it won't be a gift because what she did with that film is really impressive. I think she'll win genuinely for her work, not because it's great to have a woman and an Asian American woman to boot.
Yeah.
In there. But I think what she did with that film is so kind of daring and imaginative.
Yeah, absolutely. Ireland, Eyes could be smiling for best animated film with Wolfwalkers. Now, they haven't won in either the BAFTAs or the Golden Globes. And I've kind of been saying here that unfortunately, because I'm not sure which is better, but Soul, I think, is probably going to have it by a nose. What do you think?
Yeah, I think Soul is the front runner. It's a Disney Pixar movie, and they have a really good track record with Oscars. Their movies are always very accessible, and people liked it. I think in another year, Wolfwalkers would win because it's so imaginative. It's a beautiful, physically beautiful film to look at.
Yeah,
You know, and it's a very sweet story. But it's all about timing, and I think Soul is going to take it.
Yeah, yeah. Unfortunately, I agree with you from an Irish point of view.
Yeah.
And then finally, so best movie, what do you think? There's 8, of course.
Yeah, and, you know, this category is it's always tough to call. The conventional wisdom says Nomadland, because it's won a lot of awards. It's very popular. So that's the front runner. I think it's possible that there would be an upset here with something like Trial of the Chicago 7, because the Oscar voting is always very complicated. They because there's 8 films, they give you 8 slots and they want you to put them in order. And, you know, it's very, very Baroque way of voting. But, you know, the conventional wisdom is that it's only your top 2 choices that really get counted. If you really liked a film and made it number 4, it's like it's not going to do anything. But I think there could be an upset with Chicago 7, or Sound of Metal also has a lot of fans. But I think conventional wisdom is with Nomadland that it's going to do it.
Well, you heard it here, folks. He's telling us not to put our money on it because he doesn't gamble, but we do appreciate it. And Tim, just very finally then, and it's a huge question and we don't have time for it, but top line kind of stuff, you know, we don't talk to you half as much as we would like. It's been the strangest of years everywhere, but it's been a strange year in Hollywood. You're our man on the ground there. Is there a sense that, you know, as the business slowly starts to open up again, your vaccination rates are steaming ahead of ours? Is there a real pent-up demand for the people you know in the movie business to get back making movies?
Oh, yeah. I mean, all during the pandemic, there's several stages of making a movie. One is the preparation, the pre-production. 2 is the actual filming. And then 3 is post-production, when they do the editing, the sound effects, the visual effect. And number 1 and number 3, the preparation and the post-production, have been full steam. They've been working full time. It's only the production that's slowed down. And everybody who's involved with the production is, you know, those little toys where you get the car and you zoom, 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 so the wheels are spinning, and then you lift it up and the wheels are, you put it on the ground and it goes zooming. I think that's what that's what production is going to be like. Everybody's very eager to get going. And, you know, I think in a positive sense, this past year has been a chance to kind of reboot for everybody, not just the industry, where you just think, wait, okay, what are my priorities? What is really important that I'm doing? And what am I spending too much time in my life wasting time on? So it's been a chance to kind of a little meditative year.
I didn't know Hollywood had meditative years. So there you go.
Well, I'm giving them the benefit of the doubt.
You certainly are. But look, he had the busiest and the longest Oscar season of his long career. Tim, you deserve a lie down. He is the Oracle of Tinseltown, awards editor with Variety. Tim Gray, thank you so much for talking to me.
Always happy to talk with you.
Up next, Mark Ryle is here, chatting about the week's new releases, which include one of the best movies of the year.
Screen Time on News Talk.
Now you're listening to Screen Time, News Talk's TV and movie show. We turn to this week's new releases. I'm joined this week, as I am by just about every week. Mark Ryle was off last week as well, because I was off, and he's not allowed unless I'm allowed. But he's back, and he's here to talk about, to my mind, one of the best movies of the year, Sound of Metal, and also another movie, which appears to be less good, called The Reckoning. Hi, Mark, how are you?
It certainly is, Les. Good. I'm good, John. How are you doing?
Not too bad at all. You enjoyed the week off laying fallow?
I just stood in the wardrobe for the entire week, waiting for the call up.
Yeah, yeah. Well, here I am. Here I am. Good, good. A little seclusion. I think you needed that, you know.
Yeah, I did.
Yeah, I was kind of court ordered as well. So anyway, let's move on though. Sound of Metal, great movie. Just maybe give our listeners a sense of what's going on here. It's on Amazon since this Monday.
I had a couple of days, that's right, yeah. Riz Ahmed and Olivia Cooke play Ruben and Lou. They are a couple and they're this sort of White Stripes type of hardcore rock duo as well. As the movie begins, Ruben and Lou look like they have it all figured out. They live in this really nice Airstream RV that doubles as a recording studio and a tour bus. So they seem pretty self-sufficient, but most importantly, they seem happy. And then, of course, Ruben's world falls apart when he suddenly and irrevocably loses his hearing. Except he hasn't just lost his hearing, he's lost his livelihood and possibly his relationship with Lou. And he is also a recovering addict. And this bombshell sets off alarm bells that he might relapse along with everything else that's going on. But the problem is that he can't go to a support group because he can't hear anything. And then through his sponsor, Lou finds a support group at a retreat for the deaf community where Ruben goes and basically has to learn how to be deaf.
Mm, indeed he does. Indeed he does. And as you say, it's a it's recovery within a deaf community. It's a deaf community, but they also have a place that helps recovering addicts. And Riz Ahmed, I think it's fair to say at the outset, is pretty immense as a man losing his hero and a man losing his hearing and a man who's a musician, you know, and we've seen that or heard about that before with the likes of Beethoven, and it's happened to other well-known musicians over the years. I thought he did that emotionally and the way his physicality of relating to his hearing, I thought he was brilliant in it.
He is, yeah. It's a really, really powerful study of a man, I suppose, in free fall. And as you say, Riz Ahmed, he's perfect. He really conveys the isolation and the sheer desperation of Ruben as the direness of his situation becomes apparent. And you can read what's going through his head in his performance. And obviously he's tremendous, but everything in Sound of Metal feels incredibly authentic and lived in. And Paul Racy is so good as the head counselor at the retreat community that I had to go and check that he was actually an actor and not a real counselor.
And he's been nominated for Best Supporting Actor.
Yeah. Riz Ahmed is up for Best Actor. And I think this is also for Best Picture.
It is.
And also Darius Marder is up for Best. Oh, no, he didn't get Best Director, actually. He missed out on the Best Director. But yeah, it's nominated in a lot of categories.
Talk a little bit about the sound, because I thought the sound was brilliant in the way hearing and not hearing and what we take for granted and the noise of heavy metal. Like, the sound is a character, and the lack of it in this movie, I felt.
It's one of those movies that really reminded me of how much I missed the cinema. And that might sound odd because a lot of this is completely silent. But the sound designer, Nicholas Becker, his incredible sound design, it's like a blanket that surrounds you. And this is the kind of movie that would really, really benefit from that completely immersive experience of the cinema. And I think the importance of sound is often overlooked. And one of the most disturbing things you can do in a movie is to remove the sound completely. It's extremely disconcerting, especially when you're in a room full of people.
Yeah.
But the extraordinary thing is that Darius Marder, the writer-director, he manages to keep the viewer engaged throughout a movie with long stretches of silence and without dialogue and with a lot of sign language. And that's really, really clever writing, I think.
Absolutely. Very well said. And, you know, I don't want to talk clumsily about the condition of deafness, but one thing that I got from it was there's a philosophy of what it's like to be deaf in this. And I was saying to someone earlier in the week that what this movie portrays is that deafness is a way of being in the world, as opposed to necessarily a disability or something to be overcome. It's merely, I think, and I'm extrapolating, but the movie seems to give that sense that hearing or hearing loss and being deaf and being profoundly deaf at times is a way, another mode of existence, as opposed to something that has to be overcome or fixed. And I thought that, you know, the idea of being able to contain that idea, but not whacking it over the head with you was brilliant.
Yeah, it's not seen as an affliction or a disadvantage.
Yeah,
it's a lived experience.
Very much so. And I just want to mention Olivia Cooke as well, because, you know, she's, you could say, the second fiddle in some ways, because he's almost codependent on her, Riz Ahmed's character. But I really think, and it's not a spoiler, but in the final act of the movie, she comes into her own, and there's certain scenes, and in particular, she has this look of all knowing. I just thought she was brilliant in it.
I know exactly what you're talking about.
She was probably in it so slightly at times that maybe they didn't feel she deserved Best Supporting Actress, but I think she should have been up for it.
Yeah, possibly. She was really, really good. I was trying to remember, where did I see her before? She was really good in a movie from a few years back called Me and Earl and the Dying Girl.
That's
really
right. Yeah, that is a very good film. And finally, I just want to say about the music in it, because my wife adored this film as well. And I was telling her about it beforehand. I was just giving her the top line. And, you know, like your own good lady, she sometimes watches stuff with you because it's part of the gig. And, you know, I have to tell her what it is.
No choice in the matter.
And she was kind of going, oh, a heavy metal drummer. But like, if you have no interest in, and you know, at times this felt like the music they played was nearly death metal. It has nothing to do with heavy metal in essence. It's about a musician losing his hearing. So I'm just saying listeners shouldn't be put off by if you think you're not into death metal or heavy metal.
No, but the band that the band that they're in, I think it's called Blackgammon. I would probably go and see them.
Oh no, so would I. But I'm just saying for people who mightn't be into that, you know, I would go see any gig now. I would be front and center at a Christa Burr gig now.
Yeah, it'd be like a glass of water in the desert, wouldn't it?
Yes, indeed. So, listen, stars wise, what are you going to say?
I'm going to give this a 4. It really is incredible.
Now, for the second time this year, I'm going to give it a 5.
Are you?
And I'll tell you why, right? Because I gave Minari 5 2 weeks ago because I was thinking about this, right? We never give out 5s. You certainly rarely do, but I give them out rarely enough as well. But this was a movie I could not look away from. I didn't want to pause it from the very opening scene to the very end scene. I was transfixed. There's bits of it I want to go back and look at again because I think maybe I missed certain looks in Riz Ahmed's eyes and his demeanor at times that might have been telling us something that I missed. So to me, this had me hook, line, and sinker. So I can't not give it a 5 by that rationale, if you know what I mean.
That's fair enough. Well deserved, I think.
Thank you. Okay, very good. Well, I didn't make the movie or anything, you know, but my approbation of it is strong. Let's take a clip of Sound of Metal.
Promise. Say it, Ruby, or all of this is for shit. Say it. Promise. Go back there right now. Promise. Say it.
I promise if you...
No, say it. Promise. Go back to that place.
I need you to wait for me. Okay? You're it for me. Lou, you're my fucking heart. You're it for me. Okay? You gotta wait for me. Listen to me. Listen. When you get there, I need you to write to me, okay? Yeah? Will you write me? You tell me you're okay? Huh? Promise me? And listen, if it's bullshit, you just get your ass back here. I'll fix it, I swear to God. You know I can fix this. It's not that hard.
Sound of Metal, now available since Monday on Amazon. If you have Amazon, you should watch it because it is pretty amazing. And Mark agrees. I gave it a 5. He gave it a 4. Now, this week, not that I was lazy. I had a busy week, or maybe I was overcoming my Easter egg binge, but I didn't get to watch our second movie. But I know you did, Mark. We don't have to spend long on it because I gather The Reckoning, which is available on digital platforms, video on demand platforms from Friday, isn't very good.
Yeah, from the sublime to the not sublime. Do you remember Tropic Thunder?
Yes, of course. Yeah.
There was a made-up trailer in Tropic Thunder for a movie called Satan's Alley, which was a rip-off of In the Name of the Rose. Yeah. And I couldn't stop thinking about Satan's Alley when I was watching this.
Wow.
It's hard to talk about The Reckoning because I can't and I won't swear on national radio, but it really is an awful load of old codswallop.
Okay.
I will fill you in on the story. It is set in 1665 during the Great Plague. That is great as in enormous, not great as in fantastic. And Charlotte Kirk.
Like people call it the great pandemic of 2020 yes. and 2021. Nothing great about it.
It was a big plague. Charlotte Kirk is Grace Havistock. She's wife to a struggling farmer and mother to a newborn. And her husband succumbs suddenly to the plague. And she is left to look after the farm alone with the rent due. Then this predatory landlord shows up demanding the rent and he tries to rape her. And she manages to fight him off, but he accuses her of being a witch. And then things go from bad to worse. And by that, I mean, the movie goes from bad to worse. When Sean Pertwee shows up in an enormous hat, that should set the alarm bells ringing. Because, Sean Pertwee, he's a capable enough actor, but he is certainly not choosy. And he really is, he's like a magnet for crap. And this is exactly what the reckoning is. It's just utter crap.
I know I didn't watch it, but I read a few reviews this morning because you told me what you thought of it, just to see if you were very off-piste on it. And it seems to be uniformly being trashed. What is it that's so bad about it?
Well, we're in Uwe Boll territory here. Now, for the benefit of those blissfully unaware of who Uwe Boll is, he's the German-born director of some of the worst movies ever made, movies that were financed through a German tax loophole, which was thankfully sealed. But this has the look and feel of a bare-bones tax break shot in Hungary project that was greenlit purely as some sort of tax evasion scheme. Now, I'm not saying that it was. I am saying that it has that look and feel. The director, Neil Marshall, he started off his career with a couple of pretty decent horrors. He did the low-budget Dog Soldiers, and then he did the genuinely creepy The Descent. Mm-hmm. And he and Charlotte Kirk, who plays the lead, co-wrote this, and I presume they did so by sharing a crayon. What I will say about, I don't want to be mean, but what I'm going to say about Kirk, Charlotte Kirk, is that her abilities are a perfect match for the quality of the script. Yeah, she's pretending to embody this strong central female protagonist that's attacking institutional misogyny and objectification. But in fact, she is just encouraging institutional misogyny and objectification. And this is just, it's just torture porn masquerading under the guise of empowerment and emancipation. And it doesn't even have the benefit of being enjoyable on a kind of so bad it's good level, like some of Roger Corman's exploitation flicks. It remains stubbornly unaware of its own stupidity.
It's not only bad, but it's annoying, which is terrible. Well, listen, perhaps we shouldn't waste any more time. I mean, we were talking about Sound of Metal, and we were saying, you know, I couldn't look away the whole time. Whereas this, you probably got to the end of it.
I wanted to look away.
Yeah. Why on earth did I watch all this? Yeah.
I watched it so you don't have to.
Well, I do appreciate that. You went into Satan's Alley and came back just for us listeners. So, you know, we appreciate it. Tell me this, what would you say stars wise?
I'm going to give it a one, and that's been really, really generous.
A generous one for The Reckoning, which is available on video on demand platforms. But Mark is definitely saying don't even bother. But Mark, it was great to bother with you this week because Sound of Metal is wonderful. You're pretty good too. Thank you.
Thanks, John.
Up next, Tom Moore of Cartoon Saloon on his favorite movie. Oh, and that Oscar nomination.
Screen Time on News Talk.
Now you're listening to Screen Time News Talk's TV and movie show. It's that stage of the week where we talk to someone well known about their favourite movie. I'm delighted now to be joined by the co-founder and the co-director of Wolfwalkers and, of course, Cartoon Saloon, Tom Moore, to talk about his favourite movie and a little else besides. Tom, how are you?
I'm pretty good, thank you.
Listen, I've been doing this show 2.5 years. No one has ever chosen this movie. I think it gets a terrible rap. I think it's an extraordinary movie. So I'm delighted you've nominated this as your favorite movie. Will you tell our listeners what your favorite film is?
I think banish from your head all the sequels and open your heart to Rocky from 19.
Open your heart to Rocky. We can finish there.
His whole life was a million to one shot.
Tell people why you love it.
Why do I love it? I mean, it's the classic underdog story. I rediscovered it as a young adult when I was kind of struggling to get our first film off the ground. And I really related to this sort of down his luck, nearly 30-year-old boxer who was trying to just get a crack, one crack at the world title. And the fact that, you know, serendipity. And what I always loved about it, I think, was the beauty of the fact that he basically lost, but he won because he kind of showed everyone he wasn't just another bum from the neighborhood. And I related deeply to that, I think, at the time.
And, you know, I think Stallone, and it's because of the sequels and stuff, they wrecked it, but he gets a bad rap. But there are certain movies, and particularly this one, where he's a brilliant actor.
Yeah, I think there's something. I remember hearing a TED talk about how genius is something that you don't own, but that passes through you. And I definitely think Stallone is like that. Because every now and then, it seems like genius possesses him, some spirit from outside of him, and he does something amazing like this film. And then he sinks back into these sort of schlocky things. And for better or worse, I think this one was really from the heart, because he was at that stage himself. Rocky was a little bit of a self-reflection because, you know, He'd tried to get it made. The studios were saying if they were going to make it, it would be starring somebody else. He couldn't star in it. He ended up making it for a very low budget. And it was kind of like his last shot. He was coming to the end of his 20s and he hadn't broken through. And then all of a sudden, and it, you know, went on and won Best Picture over stuff like Taxi Driver and stuff. So
yeah,
quite an amazing achievement for a young actor breaking in, you know.
Absolutely. And do any of the sequels hold any water with you?
Only in that as a kid, I didn't realize how gritty and down to earth and kind of almost like a Christ-like kind of metaphor the first Rocky really obviously as well. I think the director, John Avildsen, brought a depth to it that maybe wasn't there in the sequels when Stallone took over and they became sort of cocaine-fueled 80s rock, you know. But Rocky turned into some kind of superhero by the time you were watching before. And again, I remember being grossly disappointed. I think it was my 14th birthday. I went to see very cheekily Rocky V with a group of friends, and it was over 15s, and it was just boring. It wasn't even what Rocky IV had been, a bit of crack, and Rocky V was just like, what's going on? But it was the reset movie. And what I will say is I really enjoyed Creed. I thought Creed was a really good film, and it felt like the spirit of the first Rocky, this down on his luck guy in Philadelphia and everything to fight for, you know.
Yeah. And then just finally on it, like, there's it's an ad for Sky, but Anthony Hopkins nominated as his favorite movie, and he's talking about him running up the steps, and he has this great line in it where in this ad for Sky where he's talking about how much he loves Rocky, and he says, yeah, it's hokey, but who cares, life is hokey. I just think that's beautiful.
Well, I don't know. I went for my 40th birthday. I trained for weeks so I could run the full Rocky run from the Italian market all the way up those steps. And I mean, it's a beautiful art museum once you go inside.
Right.
Just that moment, and every day there's someone running up it. So I remember that cold January already 3 or 4 years ago now, and it was leaving my 30s, heading into my 40s, and it felt like a triumphant moment just to run up those steps, you know.
So you were one of those annoying tourists doing the
just
Rocky thing.
Just another annoying tourist taking selfies with the statue and everything, yeah.
Fair play to you. So listen, Wolfwalkers, we'll get to. En route to that, I had the chance to interview Pete Docter a good few years ago now. And I think Song of the Sea from Your Saloon was just out. And I mentioned it to him. It was funny. And I suppose not that he was annoyed or anything, but, you know, I was saying you guys are hand-drawn and the difference between that and Pixar. And he said to me this thing, well, you know, that's true to an extent, but don't forget everything we do starts as a drawing. Some guy, it might be me, it might be someone else, starts in a room somewhere and they draw something. Sure, the computers come in, but we begin like the guys in Cartoon Saloon do as well. And it always stuck in my mind that, you know, that's maybe fair enough. And I'm wondering, what do you make of that?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I know Pete now for a long time, and he's a good guy, and he has really pushed the medium really far in a way that other CG directors haven't, because he always incorporates something of the kind of visual language of hand-drawn into his films. Even in Soul, he has the Jerrys and the Terrys that are almost like a UPA or Eastern European style animation.
Yeah.
I respect that, you know, definitely. But I just think there's a difference between the warmth of seeing the actual artist's hands on screen, and there's something timeless about it. So even though there's so much artistry in it, they're always reliant on the technology, and Pixar is all about pushing the technology. So inevitably, their stuff dates because what was amazing in 1995 in Toy Story 1 is looking at ropey now. Where if you look at like Bambi from 1940, it's still really timeless because it's a painting and it's hand-drawn. Yeah. It doesn't age in the same way. And I've chatted to Pete about that and he sort of conceded, I have that at least. But I wouldn't want to take away from the fact that they do. Like, I mean, they craft it by hand, frame by frame. But the computer adds such an extra layer of glow and sheen and stuff that it gives it a different final feeling than when I saw like 101 Dalmatians as a kid. I felt, oh, if I practice, I could do that, you know? Mm. I don't know what it feels like to be a kid looking at a Pixar film and wondering how the heck did it do that? You know, there's something tactile about the drawing, you know, for me anyway.
Sure, absolutely. And listen, finally, Wolfwalkers. Now, I'm going to be honest about this, and it's good news and bad news, but regular listeners will know when it comes to Wolfwalkers, I've said two very important things. The first one on the side of the angels is I have been evangelical about that. Ever since our mutual acquaintance, Glenn Hogarty, told me about it and I watched it, I've took my kids to see it in the cinema when the cinemas were briefly open. Sure. I have mentioned it, I'd say, once a week since now and Christmas and when it's been nominated. So I am. You probably owe me a small retainer, right?
Right.
But regular listeners will also know I did say that I don't think it's going to win. Not that it doesn't deserve to, but because I know the politics of these things and there is so much wind behind Soul. So I'm sorry I said that, but I can't lie to you, you know. What's your take on it, though? Maybe you don't care.
No, it's not that I don't care. I think it's sort of a pity that we run these huge elections after we finish a movie, trying to convince people to vote for us. And I don't think I've ever felt like we've had a fairer fight, you know, like like at the start, it felt like we actually really, really had a chance and it was close. And there's no doubt Soul has peeled away with the BAFTA and the Golden Globe and stuff. But early on, I mean, and Apple haven't relented. They're still doing amazing stuff, billboards and everything and all the marketing and everything they put into it. I've never seen like a, you know, I mean, we're about a 10% of the budget of Seoul and the effort that's been put into promoting a small, you know, a film from a small town in the middle of Ireland. It's pretty amazing that we're, you know, going one-on-one. So to me, it's sort of going up against Apollo Creed. Like if we go the distance, you know, if we just go the distance, we'll show that we're not just another bum from the neighborhood.
What a perfect radio guest. Like he ends up where he started out talking about Rocky. Well, listen, as Ray Darcy would say, you hold the hopes of the nation with you, Tom Moore, Sunday night. His favorite movie is Rocky. He's the co-director of Wolfwalkers, the co-founder of the wonderful cartoon saloon based out of Kilkenny. Tom Moore, thank you very much and the very best of luck.
Thanks a million, John.
What about my pride, Nick? At least you had a pride. I ain't had no pride, I ain't a nut. Legs are going, everything is going, no one's getting a nut. Guy comes up, offers me a fight. Big deal, wanna fight the fight? Yeah, I'll fight the big fight. I wouldn't wanna fight that big fight, it was gonna happen to me. I wanna get that! And you wanna be ringside and see it? Do you? You wanna help me out? And you come around here, you wanna move in here with me? Come on here, come to my house! Real nice, come on in and move. It stinks! Some place stinks.
A clip there from Rocky, the first movie. And as Tom Moore said, Sylvester Stallone is sometimes kind of a genius, and he certainly is in Rocky. And as Tom explained wonderfully, articulately, the first Rocky movie, Rocky, is an amazing movie, and it got lost because of all that came after it. But it is a towering achievement of cinema, as is Wolfwalkers. And I do hope it wins an Oscar, whether I think it will or not. I do hope it does. And we all do, I hope. So that is it for this week. My thanks to Tom. My thanks to Anne-Marie Kane, who helped out on the show this week, who ferreted me out an email address with great digital dexterity. I was very impressed. And he knows what I'm talking about. Next week, I'll be talking to Stuart Carolan, the writer of Love, Hate and The Alienist, and a great screenwriter. So I'm looking forward to that. Just remind you, this show is available as a podcast every Friday at 5 p.m. on newstalk.com, the Newstalk app, or wherever you get your podcasts. And of course, it's on the radio every Saturday at 6 p.m. right here on Newstalk. Just remind you, you can get in touch with me at any stage during the week. I'm open on Twitter, John_Fardy, or you can email me, screentime@newstalk.com. I will be back next week, because I know a lot of you were worried, and it was nice that you worried so much about my absence, but I will be back. I have no immediate holiday plans for a while, you'll be pleased to hear. Leave you with some music from the movies. The Wedding Singer, great movie, I like it, I gotta say. And it is a great soundtrack. And it features The Cure, so what could be wrong? So I will leave you with Boys Don't Cry and wish you all a lovely weekend.